Well, hello, dear reader, and hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 12 of the Handsome Timothy Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show, an awesome podcast you can find on iTunes. And we're also part of the Chronic Rift, a network of podcasts. Put it looking for the culture and pop culture. You can find myself and a ton of other great podcasts at www.chronicrift.com, or you could just go down to the links below. I want to thank everybody for downloading, listening, retweeting, and sharing. Got a lot of traffic and a lot of really great feedback from many of you writers and screenwriters with the Stephen J. Lawrence interview from last week. So thanks very much. Keep spreading it. These things are kind of timeless, so I won't mind if you retweet that one this week. Speaking of this week, holy cow. A guy, when I first started this is one of those people I was like, I gotta have my guest on this week. He is a writer. He's a filmmaker. He's also a historian. He's also a curator. And he is also a Hugo Award-winning fanzine editor. He is the one, the only, Mr. Fabulous, Christopher J. Garcia. Welcome to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Hey, it's great to be here. It's great to hear Mr. Fabulous because I don't hear it enough in my everyday life.
Absolutely. And hey, you can just put this on loop.
Yeah, I know. That's the beautiful thing about the electronic sound.
I know. And I know. We're doing this, over Skype, over digital. Like way back in the day, we'd have to do this on like DAT players or put it on a CDR.
Well, you know what's weird? I actually, 2 years ago, started a podcast called Hard Copy Podcast, which I believe is the only podcast ever created and distributed expressly on cassette tapes.
Wow. That's...
And the only reason I did that was I couldn't find a way to put it onto a old Edison cylinder.
Wow. So so when you gave out these cassette tapes to people, were they like, thanks? Or did you know people who could play said cassette tapes?
Some were like, where the hell are you gonna play this thing? But what's weird is that I sent it to a couple of friends of mine in Australia, and they said, well, we don't have a way to play it, but we'll give it to some friends. And it ended up being passed around the hipster community of Melbourne. So apparently the followers for my Hard Copy podcast are more in Melbourne, Australia, a city I've never been to, than they are anywhere near where I actually gave people.
That's amazing, because I have got a cult following in Australia. G'day, mates. And bang up job on catching that terrorist plot last week. It's crazy. So we're going to have to find these people, Chris, and get them to like keep spreading the word, and maybe we'll be able to get like a free flight to a convention or something in Australia.
I love where your head's at.
Yeah,
make that happen.
I'd love to. You would go, right?
Oh, totally. In a heartbeat.
All right, so Australia, you're listening. Just, you know, keeps running, keep retweeting, keep whatever the hot Australian social media thing. I got to research that more because it's I'm not sure exactly they do the same sort of social media stuff as the rest of us, but.
Well, you know, they are big on Facebook. Their tail on MySpace is longer than any other country.
Really?
It's really strange is that, because every one of these social networks has sort of a dying tail.
Mm.
And MySpace is particularly long in Australia and in Iran, of all places.
But, you know, it's interesting. Every culture is a little bit different, and every one of these social media things is going to fit that specific culture's needs and wants. So it kind of makes sense to me that Iran might be way behind. They might log on to MySpace and be like, wow, this is the greatest thing ever, whereas Canada, they may not touch it at all.
Exactly.
But I'm not an anthropologist, so what the hell do I know? Well, so anyway, I want to have you on to talk about cassettes in Australia. Now, are you launching this film festival? I was actually looking for a specific reason. Let me just, full disclosure, I was like, I got to have Chris on. And, you know, you're kind of crazy, and I mean that in a good way, because you'll talk about anything. But I thought, no, I want to have a specific thing on. And then you sent me your link for your Facebook page for the Silicon Valley Science Fiction Short Film Festival. And I thought, awesome, I haven't really covered film festivals yet. Haven't had you on. Perfect. Because otherwise, we're just going to talk about your ideas for booking Goldust versus Doink the Clown with Luce Thess as a special ref.
It'd be awesome. I'm telling you, still, going to happen. It's going to be huge.
Somewhere.
Luce availability is iffy, but it's going to happen.
Somewhere in San Jose, Dave Meltzer just got so mad, and he doesn't know why. He's like looking at his family like, I'm so mad. I don't know why. But this disturbance is making me so mad. I mean, I would love, Dave, if you ever hear this. So, but anyway, let's talk about the Silicon Valley Science Fiction Short Film Festival. Tell us what that's all about.
Well, back in 2000, I got interested in short films. And it all started literally because of the exploding whale film you would be able to download off the internet back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I love short films. I love the idea of being able to show short films on the internet. So I started to gather short films, and I figured, well, I've always loved science fiction, so I'll do a science fiction short film festival. And we did that twice. We had the strangest... Since I had no money, we had to find ways to put it on, so mm-hmm. we literally projected it on Waz's garage one time.
Well, that's better than cassette tape. That's not how you want to show films.
Exactly. You know, community centers, libraries, and it went dormant for about 8 or 9 years. And last year, I was sitting around thinking, you know what? I have maybe 15 free minutes a day. I could easily put together the film festival again. So started it back up. And what happened, and I was not expecting this at all, was we got submissions of films from more than 50 countries.
Wow.
I was shocked. Everything we did virtually. Everything you could submit online, you could give us the screeners. It was wonderful. And we're seeing films from, you know, Canada, the U.S., Mexico. We have films from Iraq. We got films from East Timor was the most interesting one.
Sure, but I mean, you know, it's these places with political upheaval.
Yeah.
These are people, this is how you can't necessarily fight City Hall, but you can make a movie about it. And I don't mean that glibly. Like, that's a way to express discontent and express yourself.
And it's a great way to make zombie movies, it turns out.
Zombies are a great metaphor. Go back and listen to episode 9 with Arnold T. Blumberg.
Yeah, but what's amazing is sadly, the worstly shot films, worstly is a word, was this awesome zombie film. And I say awesome in the fact that it was a sweeping vista because it was shot on a mountaintop in Indonesia.
Wow.
Completely in incredibly deep focus. And all the action took place about 50 yards from the camera. And it was creepy as all get out, but it looked like it was shot on a Super 8.
Yeah.
And it was like, I wish they had, you know, I would have ponied up for a Kickstarter to buy them time on a Red Epic. Because that would have been like, this was, the filmmaking was amazing. What they were using just right. didn't translate.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that, like the, you know, because like back in the day, you know, like when I was at Emerson, it was like, you know, $30,000 to make a short film for your master's or whatever. And it was like, oh my God. And nowadays, like the technology, and I know, you know, we went through the resistance of digital film into digital, but the mm-hmm. digital world has opened up just a whole landscape of opportunity for filmmakers.
What's amazing is I've been programming with the Cinequest Film Festival here in San Jose mm-hmm. for 15 years now. And what I have seen is that not only are films getting easier to make, they're looking better. Mm-hmm. The storytelling now is, in the old days, it used to be you could disqualify, you know, 2/3 of the movies because they were lit poorly. They yeah. had terrible sound.
Yeah.
That is leveled.
Yeah.
And now what you're seeing is you can really concentrate on the story.
I love it.
And it's exactly what everyone was hoping would happen. We've learned, you know, the things that happen is, one thing that I love is, you know, working with kids. We have a couple of films in the festival this year made by teenagers. And their visions are incredible because I'm looking at it going, I wanted to make this movie when I was 13. Right. I can remember sitting around with folks saying, if we just had money, I could make this movie.
Right, and, but you didn't have an extra 55 grand to make a 16mm film.
Exactly, and these kids are doing it, and they're amazing.
And they don't need the 55 grand.
No.
Now, are you finding out what these teenagers, though, are they using, because I always, you know, kind of bristle whenever somebody says to me, like, did you hear about that movie somebody made on their iPhone? I'm like, well, hold on, calm down, calm yourself for a second. It's not necessarily a movie. And just because it's on the iPhone doesn't mean it's make it good. Like, what technologies and what avenues are you noticing some of the kids today using to make these films?
The iPhone is the big one, of course, and what's incredible is that I have seen some of the best films I have seen this year from a storytelling point of view have been on the iPhone. Mm-hmm. What's amazing to me is that some of the movies that are the most inventive cinematography-wise are shot on the iPhone.
Really?
Which is, it blows my mind that you could do things like not only good swish pans,
mm-hmm.
but good swish pans to pull back focus, to rainy vision. Like, it's obvious that folks are experimenting. And that's one of the things, you know, one of the reasons why I love early film, I've been a silent film geek for a long time, is that a lot of times it was just, I want to be able to try this effect.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that again. And it's awesome.
It's so funny. I'm reminded of the David Bowie quote, I think he said in the History of Rock and Roll, that PBS documentary from years ago. I think he said something like, with the synthesizers, I didn't know what the fuck this was. We didn't know. So we just pushed a lot of buttons. And this is David Bowie in the 70s, and it turned into one of the most influential sounds. So I'm just reminded of that story when hearing that. It's like, it sounds like a lot of these kids and people from these other countries are really almost embracing the limitations and just seeing how far they can push it.
And that's a beautiful thing. One of the reasons why there are so many now filmmakers in places like Iran, in a lot of the Arab Spring countries, is that a ton of iPhones, cheap video cameras of any sort, were sent there during the Arab Spring. Because they wanted to be able to document what was going on, not only for posterity, but just for personal safety.
Yeah.
And so I guarantee you, like three or four of the films that I saw from Tunisia or Iran or any of those countries were from cameras that had been sent there specifically to document the Arab Spring.
I can vouch for that because I know a reporter who was very worried about his sources in Egypt at the time. So, well, yeah, that's crazy. It's interesting, the idea of, like, because I think the lesson, though, for folks who aren't doing this stuff, I think, I kind of including myself, I'm not really a natural director. I'm much more of a writer. But I'm hearing a real interesting lesson, which is, like, use whatever is available to you and embrace the limitations and figure out what you can do to make a story with what you got. Because not having $1 million and not having the best equipment just ain't an excuse anymore.
No, it's not. And, you know, I made a documentary on this little rock club in San Jose called the Cactus Club, and I produced it, and we made the entire thing, including getting rights for the music, which was insanely nuts considering some of the stuff we did.
Oh, God, yeah, that's a killer.
For less than $5,000.
Wow.
And it's a really good little documentary. You can find it on YouTube. And, you know, it did what we wanted to do. For even less money than we thought we were ever going to need.
Well, there's going to be a link at the bottom, so anybody who wants to check it out, we'll scroll down, and we'll put up a link for you. Wow. How'd you pull off the music rights?
Mostly, we got a whole bunch of, hey, can you do us a huge favor?
Sure.
And, you know, people did us huge favors.
It's a funny, weird thing of, like, and I've been really in the world of networking and stuff this past year, almost more so than the world of writing, with this podcast and things like that. And it's really stunning to me, and I've learned it, and I think there's a lesson there of, like, what you actually can get from people if you actually ask nicely and, like, reciprocate some sort of token of appreciation. I don't mean that, like, in a bribe, but because it's shocking how many people are willing to help out, are willing to be a part of something, and are willing to say, yes, I want to be part of this project and this thing.
My dream project for film is a 3-minute documentary called Whatever Happened to Pong, based on the song by Frank Black, Whatever Happened to Pong. And I ran into him after a show one time, and I said, I got this idea for a documentary. And I told him about it, and he was like, that is the stupidest idea I ever heard, but I'll make you a deal. If you can get the inventor of Pong to ask me, I will say yes. And I'm like, do you want me to have him call you now or later? And he's like, if you can get him on the phone now, I'll say yes. And I haven't done it yet, but I was talking to him the other day saying, I need you to do me a favor.
Well,
which is one of the things in the world that, you know.
You could just drop this podcast on him. Just be like, hey, listen to this, you know, and this is your way of asking.
Yeah. What's amazing is that this is one of the things I love about networking. Is that everyone has their things, and the deeper you dive into your different things, the more you find that they're all connected. And even the things that are completely separate, science fiction fandom, which I've been a part of most of my life,
yeah,
and wrestling fandom, overlap hugely. And I've had conversations at sci-fi conventions about wrestling, and I've run into people in wrestling, particularly in the old RSPW days on the old Usenet boards, who just wanted to talk about the newest Neal Stephenson book. And when you're looking to, you know, if you want to make a movie about, for example, I was working on this documentary for 2 years about painting, and I needed to get to a specific painter who paints boxing scenes. And I'm not in boxing fandom particularly, but I happened to know that through the Computer History Museum where I work, there was a guy who happened to be a big boxing fan, so I asked him, and he said, well, I don't know him, but I ride motorcycles with a whole bunch of MMA guys, and bounce, 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 and it ended up there. And it was only because I, you know, have dedicated myself, really, to diving deeply into what the things that I love, that I've been able to find all these wonderful things that make this fun stuff happen.
I think that's such an amazing point, because establishing rapport is really vital, because I think far too many, I've heard a lot of, there's numerous articles out there and other podcasts have talked about these lessons in networking, which is, do you know, a lot of people will be willing to mentor you and help you as screenwriters and stuff, but don't be the selfish dick who's literally just, what can you do for me?
Yeah, don't be the guy at the convention who is hanging out, talking to the editors, pitching them their stories. Be the guy at the convention, drinking with the editors, finding out their stories.
Exactly. And because and not only that, that will probably be almost more worthwhile to you than just a straight up, okay, we're all looking for that magic break, like that magic door that's going to open, but it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, it so seldomly does. And one of the keys is so often that magic break may happen once in your lifetime. And if you don't jump on it, you know, you're doomed. I had, you know, when I won the Hugo, not only the acceptance speech, but, you know, realizing that this was my moment. I was being recognized by a worldwide, you know, group of people for something I, you know, love doing. Now it's time to actually do something with it. And it happened that this, you know, managed to get me enough attention to be able to put out what I consider to be the best work I'd ever done.
And you see, that's a great lesson too. I love hearing that, which is, you know, because you went through quite a journey. We'll talk about that in a second. You, dear listener, in case you're like, oh, well, Chris did some good work on a fanzine and he won a Hugo. Oh, no, that's not the story. But what's interesting is that one would think, well, let's talk about that for a second. You did not win the Hugo the first time out. You went through actually quite a journey.
Yeah, I was. It was on my 10th nomination.
that's a lot, dude. I mean, a lot of folks would give up after like the second or third nomination.
And what's so weird is that, so what happened was I started doing it, and I was kind of doing it in this bubble. I kind of figured I was writing and putting this stuff out, and like four or five people were reading it.
But this is, let's just be clear for a second, though. This is for the Drink Tank?
The Drink Tank, yeah.
Which is a fanzine.
Mm-hmm. It's a fanzine dedicated to, I like to say, it's a fanzine dedicated to my mind droppings.
Okay.
It is all the things I think about and stuff from other people that I gather that sort of help form this idea. If you read all the Drink Tanks back, you would completely understand who I am and the world in which I live and what I think about. Which is probably makes it the world's most egotistical publication, because really it's nothing more than stuff that makes me interested. And so
it's almost like a public diary.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's slightly more focused. It's slightly more laid out. What's shocking is that the Drink Tank managed to gather a following specifically because it wasn't about one thing.
Right. And you were saying you started with four or five people. I cut you off there just for a little Basil exposition. So you started and only like a few folks were listening, and now it turns into a bigger kind of following.
Exactly. And what happened almost immediately was that people started noticing. And so the first year it was eligible for Hugo, it didn't make the ballot. It wasn't nominated.
Okay.
But it came close. And this blew me away. I had no idea that would ever happen. The next year I ended up on the ballot. And the first time you're nominated for something like that, something that I had built up the Hugo in my mind for years as being this huge representation of the taste of the people I really respect and love and the community I've been a part of all my life. And it was mind-blowing that I am now on this list with people who I endlessly respect and have all my life. And I lost that first year, and I was like, you know, I was nominated. That's all that matters. The second year when I got nominated, I was up against an author named John Scalzi.
Oh, curses John Scalzi. I've never, I don't know.
He's a great guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
Absolutely, for the record.
Yeah, and I was like, you know, all my life I'll be able to say I was on the ballot with John Scalzi. And then the next year, and kept going. And I never really got down, but there was this guy who had the shirt that said 6-time Hugo loser. And he had worn it in 1980 when he lost his 6th Hugo. And I had seen a photo of it, and I said, send that to me. So he sent it to me, and I wore it again. And I have sworn the next time I know someone who has lost a Hugo 6 times, I am giving them the shirt to wear. And it's going to become this hand-me-down tradition. But yeah, it's an honor, you know, it's weird to say, it's an honor just to be nominated. But
I think that's very true.
It's
I
so
really
true.
Do.
And with the Hugo, it's even better because you have a pre-party and the food is good.
Oh, that's hey, writers are always looking for a free meal.
Exactly. And that's where you get it.
Now, just for the non-sci-fi fans out there, I mean, the Hugo has been won by people like, I mean, Stephen Moffat, Neil Gaiman in recent years. But I believe even like Robert A. Heinlein is running it. I mean, this is the cream of the crop. These are the sci-fi Oscars, science fiction Oscars.
Exactly. And they honor books. They honor movies, short stories, of course, art, related works, which are sort of nebulous. And then there are also categories for fans.
Right.
Fan artist, fan writer, fanzine, podcasts. And so anyone who is anyone in science fiction is one. With one exception, my personal favorite writer in the world, a guy named Tim Powers, has never even been nominated. And that was part of my, when I won, why I had my breakdown, was realizing that while I was going up to stage.
I wouldn't call it a breakdown. I think, I mean, hopefully with Chris's permission, he'll let me put the video on the links below.
Oh, absolutely.
And, okay, so the links below. And you are very much overcome. I can run up Dusty Rhodes. He's overcome.
That's right. I had a spell. It was weird because, you know, I won. I had built it up in my mind. And the sadistic bastards at award shows who put memorial crawls up. And the memorial crawl had been right before they started giving out the awards.
Oh, so you already are in a place of deep emotion.
Exactly. And I hadn't slept for like 4 days. A Worldcon will do that to you. And so there I was. I was like, oh, God, Mike Glick's in my hero. And, you know, you hear your name, and then you stop for a second, and you sort of go, wow, you know, I have to collect myself so I can go up there and be dignified. I didn't take that moment.
You definitely put the hug in Hugo.
Exactly. And I jumped up, and the first thing I did was I kissed the chairman of the convention, and then her husband, and and then Tim Powers, my favorite writer on earth, was looking at me saying, "You won! You won!" And I hugged him. And then it all just hit me. It's like, yeah, I won a Hugo. And at that point, I just lost it.
But I mean, dude, it's a special moment.
It is.
I mean, listen to what you just described, especially with the idea of the hero who wasn't even nominated. I mean, gosh, how wonderful is that? And I don't mean that wonderful in that he never won. I wish Tim Powers would be here this. I wish you had won. But that's such a cool perspective, you know? Like, because it brings it home. I think you actually sound quite humble when you say that.
The other thing was, I realized this later, and I am endlessly grateful to myself for this, is that I didn't try to be anything other than in the moment, at that moment, and feeling what I was feeling, and
it was a little bigger than I expected.
But you've got, I mean, I feel like, and this is, again, like, this is mainly a screenwriting blog and podcast. If you're a writer and you try to write dishonestly, if you try to write not your voice, if you're not yourself, you're screwed. And yeah. your work is going to suffer and everything like that. I'm reminded of that watching your speech of, like, just, God damn it, be yourself. There's nothing to be, what are you going to be embarrassed about?
Who cares? Exactly.
Who cares, you know? And I don't think you ever, I've never known you to be embarrassed by anything, Chris.
Oh, it's very rare, but my fiance has managed a couple times.
Well, that's what they're for.
Exactly. Yeah, and it was, and you know, the other thing that happened was, so when I won, the next year, the acceptance speech was nominated for a Hugo, and it was up against 3 episodes of Doctor Who, an episode of Community, my favorite show ever, and then me and my buddy James, who won with me. And so I got to be in the official photo for the category. It was me, Dan Harmon, and Chris McKenna from Community.
Wow.
And Neil Gaiman.
So your head must have exploded then, too.
And yeah, it was like, oh my God, this is like the wow. And, you know, you guys are like important. We just are wearing nice shoes. And it was like, man. And that was, and that day was even weirder because I knew I was going to lose. I knew I was going to come in last. But I got the best gift I got that night was, you know, having lost my at that point, 14, because I was nominated for 4 in 1 year, lost my 14th Hugo, and Story Musgrave, a man who has walked on the frickin' moon, came up to me and said, "You'll get him next time."
Outstanding.
Yeah.
I'm not going to argue with him.
Nope, not me either.
So, well, let me ask you, because, like, you've talked a lot about the big moments, and it was really nice of you to go through, like, that was a big moment, and that was even bigger, and blah, blah, blah. But I think that, you know, do those moments outweigh and overshadow the losses? Because every time there's a loss, I know that no matter what, even though you say it's an honor to be nominated, it does suck a little bit to lose.
It sucks a little bit to lose, but on the other hand, what you realize is, and this is the best thing, before the Hugos, there are roll calls for photos.
Mm-hmm.
And you're sitting with the people you're nominated with, and you're looking around and you're realizing, you know, these are my peers. These are the folks who are doing what I'm doing, and they're doing it incredibly well, and I'm with them.
Yeah.
And so it lessens the blow, but yeah. It does kind of suck.
Well, it's not even that you're mad at anybody else for winning, but, you know, you can't be mad at somebody for winning an award or getting a break. I think that's, we always do. We always have that little like, but that's silly and it's not productive or pragmatic, but it always does sort of like, damn it. There's always that little damn it. But it seems like the bigger moments outweigh, and I think that's a good perspective and reminder. You know, if you have, because that's the thing, I feel like if you're a writer, you send out 100 query letters and you get 99 rejections, but then you get that one yes, you're going to forget about those 99 no's in a heartbeat because you just need that one yes, you know?
It's the other, one of the other areas that I've really been active in over the years has been poker.
Mm-hmm.
And what you realize is that poker is the exact opposite of everything else in my life. And that's why I sort of need it, is that in poker, you never remember your wins, but you will always remember that bad beat, the time that they got the card on the river that they needed to make their hand and beat your nuts flush. And that is the exact opposite of what it is to be nominated for an award, because you're more than likely going to lose. Unless, you know, you're an absolute deadlock, you're likely going to lose because your odds are 1 in 5, 7, 10, whatever. But you always remember that you got to this point.
Yeah.
And that's the most important.
That's the
thing.
At
least to me.
I think your story about sitting taking the picture is a great one, because that's why it is an honor to be nominated.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Really is. Look at these people. They're freaking amazing. They're super talented, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I have a couple of friends who made this wonderful short film called The Fabulous Flying Books of Mr. Morris Lessmore. And it world premiered at CineQuest. I was on the team that programmed it. And it won the Oscar.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, they
they did another movie, and I was talking to one of them, and I asked, you know, what was it like to win the Oscar? And they said, I don't remember winning it much, but I remember the day we found out we were nominated as being better than the day my kids were born.
Wow.
And I'm like, that blew my mind.
Hope the kids never hear that story.
Exactly. Or they have a good outlook on life.
Sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that none of that stuff, far too many people say it for it to be bullshit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I agree. Tell us about some of your documentaries that you're making, because it sounds like you're, and where can we find these? I know you said YouTube, if they're all, you know, we'll put a couple links and stuff like that. Like, where is a good place to look for some of these, I don't want to say obscure, but like some off of the beaten path and things like that. Because I always hate it when people say, oh, there's no good movies out there anymore. And I'm like, especially in this day and age, there's a ton of great movies and a ton of great material out there. You just sort of have to look a little bit.
Yeah, there's a huge amount of incredible material out there. And one of the problems is that we're sort of in this brackish, swampy world in between the old paradigm of distribution and the new paradigms.
Right.
And so what's happened with short films is a lot of short filmmakers are afraid to put their films online because they'll feel like they'll never be able to recoup any of their money because it'll be online and no distributor will ever want it. That does have some truth still, but not a lot. A film, there's an amazing zombie film again, which is name escaping me completely right
now. Is it Wrestlers versus Zombies?
No, Wrestlers versus Zombies is great. Yeah. Have you seen it?
Yes. I actually haven't yet, believe it or not. It's in my queue.
It's a short film about a dad who gets bitten and has his kid on his back, and he has to get the kid to safety before he becomes a zombie. And it's heartbreakingly beautiful.
I think I've heard of this one. Why am I escaping on it, too?
Yeah, it's Australian. It's one word, and it's... Oh, I should have researched this. But anyhow.
No, this is warts and all.
Yeah, exactly. And that whole concept of, you know, that was able to get out there and seen by thousands of people, played dozens of film festivals, even though it was freely available online. And, you know, that sort of concept, what is the two best places I can say, if you want to see quality films, Vimeo, just go to Vimeo and... check everything there. Just go literally. There's a lot of curated lists, like top picks. If you just do searching, it's great. But the other thing is there is a site called Short Film of the Week. And it does it in various genres. You can find science fiction short films, fantasy short films, horror short films. And they are wonderful. It's just, I haven't seen a bad one. They're broken out into genres and everything like that. Just, it's great to go through and just look at them. And find these wonderful films that are so under the radar at times, but they're out there and they're ready for everyone. And YouTube has done a great job of giving filmmakers a place to go and, you know, to put their films up. Vimeo does the same thing. My documentaries are on YouTube. You can find some of my other documentaries that I've done that I wouldn't really call documentaries. They're more exploratory, fun little video series. Where I would go to a convention, it was called Five Cons, me and my then girlfriend would go, and we would shoot a whole bunch of interviews and stuff going on and just try to give a sense of what the con was. And that was like great, not only because we got to go to the conventions, but because we got to find people's new, we got to find out why people did this.
Yeah.
And even worse, or even better, I mean, was we got to find out what it meant to them. And in a way that, you know, it's sort of, you think, well, if, you know, why do they go is kind of what it means to them. But then you sort of realize there are these millions of little things. Because everyone says, a great example is Gallifrey.
Yeah.
When we were interviewing some people there, I had a wonderful conversation with just J. Random person dressed as Femme Jack Harkness. And I asked, so, you know, why do you come to conventions and why do you come to Gallifrey? He says, well, it's the only place where I can wear my Jack Harkness outfit and not feel out of place. And then I said, okay, and what does it mean to you? And sort of stopped and said, it means that when I get here, I don't feel as isolated anymore.
Yeah.
And that just, that whole thing, that whole concept of having a place where you belong, really, that really informed a lot of what I was doing in my documentary work. The next one that we're doing is called At the Canvas. It's the at sign, the canvas, which is about how artists approach art and then how they approach what's already there. And so we're trying to figure out not only what does the process mean, but what do, again, those limitations mean? What do the being, you know, presented, you have a canvas, so the first artist is going to paint. The second artist is going to come and create around, perhaps over, what that first person has created. And we're going to document the entire process.
And that's happening in the world of writing all the fucking time.
Exactly.
I mean, you can do a great one on writing in that regard, and the fact that Breaking Bad, I believe, has remade every Western ever made.
Yes.
At one point or another during the season, and unapologetically. You know, like even Vince Gilligan on Colbert. And Colbert's like, how'd you come up with that ending? And he's like, oh, I was watching The Searchers. He doesn't even hide. He's like, I stole from The Searchers, goddammit.
Yeah.
But it isn't The Searchers if you watch it. I mean, it is the similar brushstrokes, but it's a different picture.
Exactly. And, you know, getting the idea that it is okay to take something someone has created and work around it, but also in it.
Yeah.
And that, you know, you have to be respectful. You have to be focused. And in a way, actually, at times even, and I've seen this particularly in writers who take works that were outmoded, that were, you know, of their time, that were racist, sexist, whatever. And there's time when being disrespectful to the work, in a way, mocking it even openly, is a way of paying it respect. It's a way of saying it mattered, but now it's different.
I can't help but think of I'm watching the original Star Trek.
Interesting.
And, oh my God. I mean, fall out of your chair sexism in the first season.
Absolutely.
I mean, where is the enlightened world that she was talking about? I mean, it's obviously there with Lieutenant Uhura and Chekhov. And it's weird because for me, I'm almost more in shock about the Russian being on board the bridge.
Yes.
Than the African American. And I'm not trying to demean Uhura because, I mean, Martin Luther King chimed in and said Uhura was important. So she's very important and it's a historical part of TV. But I felt like in that period of time, like in between, because I believe it aired 66 to 68, 69.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, there was going to be a black character in a pivotal role. Bill Cosby was an I Spy not super long after that. It was going there. But to put a Russian in the height of the Cold War, you know what I mean? That almost, to me, is almost more shocking. But yeah, I think it is important to acknowledge the period of time and the context in which things were created.
Yeah, and it's
sensibilities.
It's hard to do. For example, the new Star Trek movies have, I won't say they have tried to clean everything up,
mm-hmm.
because there is still a lot, I mean, particularly in the last one, but they have approached it with both reverence and a bit of challenge.
Yeah.
And I like that. I like that a lot.
I quite agree with you on that front. I think some of your other themes, just not to get too far away from what you're doing with your sort of thought pieces here and everything, it's a tricky deal because, like, I mean, further, you're like the Jodorowsky of San Jose. I want to see the Chris Garcia's Dune one day. So do me a favor and start developing a Dune movie that will never get made because I want to see a documentary about it. I don't want to see your Dune. I want to see the documentary about your Dune.
I've done whole issues about Dune. One of my zines, Journey Planet, we did an entire issue dedicated to Dune. And my big pitch was I did three different versions of alternate Dune doing reviews on them. And one of them was Frank Herbert couldn't get the book written or published. So he decided to make it into a comic strip. And
fine comic strip.
Yes, and I actually had this section where it was the scene where he puts his hand in the box.
Yeah.
And
there is no fear.
Yeah, there
I will
is
not
no
fear. The fear is the mind killer.
Exactly. And, you know, the scene happens. Take your hand out of the box, human. And then I see the truth in it. And then, like, this little mouse character jumps on his shoulder and says, gee, Paul, that one was close. And would have been brilliant.
Now, is that mouse Muad'Dib?
Sure.
Because that was the Fremen word for the mouse. Remember, Muad'Dib was the mouse you saw on the rocks.
That was the mouse shadow in the second moon. You're right.
So was that. So, spoiler, Dune fans.
Yeah. I don't think you can spoil Dune. Everyone's either read it or complained about any of the movies.
Well, I think the sci-fi miniseries were fantastic. I really liked John Harrison's work. No, didn't love him?
I didn't love them. I liked them. I honestly wish they had taken the aesthetic from the Lynch and applied it to the screenwriting of the sci-fi series.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. But considering the budget they had, I mean, they shot the whole thing in like 30 days or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is nuts. I mean, crazy nuts. And I remember watching it when I had just gotten in the business. So I was really, truly appreciating that, like, when they started talking about all their schedule, I was like, oh my God, these people are crazy. But they did it, and I thought they did a fantastic job. But what's crazy to me is, and I don't want to sound too disparaging, because these are fellow professionals of mine, I don't know why they're doing a Dune feature when that story is tailor-made for, like, a 12-season. I swear to God, I mean, the first Dune book alone could be a 3 or 4 season series.
You know, it's interesting. I don't think so.
Oh, you're crazy.
And here's why. And here's exactly why. Because the book Dune has a middle section, which Frank Herbert should have cut out in, like, the negative first draft.
It's
Paul and Jessica go camping. That's basically what
it is. That's 20 minutes. That's 20 minutes. That doesn't have to be four. Well, excuse me, though. Are you watching the Game of Thrones?
I am not.
Okay, well, let's just say there's some Paul and Jessica go camping scenes for about a whole season with Jon Snow, spoiler alert, where he goes camping for like 4 or 5 episodes, and that show's hot as a pistol.
That's true.
I think it's interesting with Dune because you can do I don't want to... Well, it is what it is. We're going Dune here. It's one of the three best books I've ever read, and we'll always argue it is one of the science fiction books that rises above the genre into true literature.
I will agree with you on that point, but it's not one of my favorites just because literally there is that middle section that was hard to go.
That's totally fair enough, of course.
Yeah. I will say this, though. One of the formative books in my writing style was the Dune Encyclopedia, a completely unauthorized book that took the Dune mythology. At that point, it was only, I think, 3 or 4 novels. And it made this hugely rich backstory and presented it in encyclopedia form. And I read that as a kid, having not read Dune, having only seen the movie.
Right.
And I was like, this is the greatest world ever created. This is the world I would live in if I could. It made me almost study Arabic, so I would get all the words. That book, which is so weird, is that, you know, it's a fake reference book, turned out to be the book that has inspired what I do a lot of the time, my fake nonfiction.
You never know. I mean, that's the thing, where inspiration strikes. The one thing I will say is, like, one of the things I love about the Dune book, and this actually speaks to that section of the book you don't like, is when I read the book, I pictured Paul Atreides as a little kid. Because he was. He was like 13 or something when they started the book, I believe, or 15.
Yeah.
But by the time he goes to the desert, and Leto has been killed, and Jessica is starting to lose her mind, and he finds the Fremen, he becomes a man. And I actually pictured a different person. He was the same. He almost like he regenerated. Like, I would have done a different actor. Like, I would have ended the season at season 1 and started season 2 with an older actor as Paul Atreides. And that really, that was very powerful to me. Yeah. But to go back, speaking of Jodorowsky's Dune, though, let me see if I could segue this right. Jodorowsky's Dune played for about a week here in beautiful tropical Long Beach, California. It played for a week at our local art house cinema on 4th Street. And do you see, going back to the film distribution markets and stuff like that, do you see the rebirth or almost resurrection, or hopefully saving, of the art house cinema?
Absolutely. And here's the funny thing. It is the resurrection of the art house cinema as a segment of the Megaplex.
And really?
Yeah, you're seeing this particularly with the Century Theater chain, now owned by Cinemark, which is doing... they're having 2 or 3 screens in the multiplex that are showing art house films.
Mm-hmm.
I went to go see, I literally walked across the street from work to go to the big multiplex, which was showing you know, Guardians of the Galaxy and all the other things. And then they were showing If I Stay on a screen and Boyhood on another one.
Right.
And, you know, this is, and yeah, those are sort of, I would almost say borderline art house picks, but you're starting to see this at other locations where there are the legitimate, you know, where else are you going to see a Spanish documentary other than at these small little portions? And one of the reasons for that is that when you do a traditional release of a big film, you're usually locked in for a number of weeks. And at the tail end of that, you're not going to draw.
Right.
But you are guaranteed to have a small-ish but dependable audience for art house picks. And that is perfect for the Megaplex business model, because it keeps just enough people coming in to get the admission numbers, to buy the candy. Funny thing, though, we have a local art house here that I was talking with and said, yeah, so they have two floors that are specifically big release features and one full floor, I think four screens, which are just flat art house. And I asked, you know, well, you know, why do you do both? And they say, well, the sales for tickets on the big budget pictures keep us open, but it's the concessions for the art house that do twice as much as for the big ticket. And I was like, what? So per seat, they're making way more on the art house pictures than they are on the traditional, which just blew my mind. And it spoke to something that I always believed about movies, is that there are people who really believe that movies are something special. Mm. And if you can cater to them, they're going to spend more of their money. They're going to make it more of an experience. This is like when I was talking with...
See, I want to put that on like a banner somewhere. Those two sentences you just said. Yeah. That's absolutely true. I didn't mean to cut you off, though. You were talking to him.
I think it was Les Thatcher. The one time I met him, said to me, you pay your mortgage with your hardcores. You buy your boat with your casuals.
Mm.
You can depend on your hardcores to always give you everything to actually live off of. When you can get the casuals, it's great because you can afford to get a new bass boat.
Right. It's true, but I think, you know, I'm going to have a line producer on hopefully in the next couple of weeks, and we're going to talk about it. It's a good preview, though, because I feel like with indie, with VOD, and in this changing new murky world you were talking about, the business models are also shifting and changing. They are there to able to make a profit off of this stuff. Not only just be able to make a movie for X amount of dollars, but to be able to draw some money.
And what we're seeing is money is happening again. Mm-hmm. There was a time when I'm so glad it was pretty much from about 2000 to about 2004, when the riskiest thing you could do is to try a non-traditional release of your film. Blair Witch had happened, made huge amounts of money, but it made people realize that the reason it made huge amounts of money was it was doing a traditional form of release with non-traditional marketing.
Right.
And everyone thought what it really was, what the message people were taking away, particularly small-time filmmakers on the festival circuit, was this was a non-traditional release because of the non-traditional marketing. And, you know, now we've gotten to a point where you're getting VOD is making big money. You're starting to see, again, a release of sort of the one-night stands, where small films made for, you know, not too much money will do one or two nights in a theater, and they can start to recoup their money. We're seeing small releases, like a recently Friended to Death, a wonderful film that showed at Cinequest this year, got a small release and actually started to make back its money. And there are now, what's amazing is there are more venues for making money. It is easier now to pirate movies than it's ever been. And yet, we're starting to see that even though it's easier to pirate films, people want a legitimate experience.
Yeah, you know why pirating has not destroyed the movie business the way it destroyed music?
No.
I'll tell you why.
Why is
it? It's so fucking simple. You get your money's worth with movies. You do. And you know something? Even when the box office went skyrocketing to, like, you know, because to go to, like, the Arclight here in L.A. is, like, $17, $18, $20 sometimes. Wow. Going to a 3D film will be, like, you know, if Megan and I want to go see a 3D feature with popcorn and everything like that, it's a $50 night. But here's the thing. If you're having an experience and you're having a nice thing, you don't really notice it. And here's the other thing. If I don't want to go to the theater, I could rent a movie on iTunes for a buck or two. I could go and buy a Blu-ray for a couple of bucks. Or I could go buy, if I really want to own a Blu-ray, I'm talking $15, $20. That's not challenging disposable income. If I really want the DVD, nowadays you get DVD for like $5. And 10 years ago, you could go to the store. If I had $20 disposable income, I could go to Best Buy in 2003 and buy four DVDs or maybe one CD.
Yeah.
What are you going to do? You know, exactly. You're going to buy the four goddamn DVDs. You are going to do the buying public has never, like, when people did Napster and really downloaded music, you could almost hear people being like, yeah, fuck you and your $17 CDs. There was a real underlying, like, finally, I'm getting what I want without being screwed for it. You don't hear that resentment toward the movie world.
No, and one of the reasons for that, I think, is that we've seen two things happen. One, we've seen a higher quality in audiovisual entertainment, in movies, and in particular in television, that have, I would say, lower barriers of entry. It is easier for someone to go and experience a movie than it is for someone to really appreciate an album, for example. What's the amazing thing is that with all this huge amounts of quality is that it's still far too often that it's the low quality material that makes a lot of money. This is true in all aspects still today. Books, 50 Shades of Grey is a great example. Not exactly literature. Boatloads of cash dropped on her door. Same thing with, you know, if you look at a movie like the original Expendables had its place. The Expendables 2 had no reason to exist. But
look at Expendables 3. That died a quick death.
And I hate to say this, because I have to say, Expendables 3 was an enjoyable, was it 5.5, 6 hours? It felt like it.
I haven't seen it. It has not penetrated my sphere of influence. Here's my problem with the Expendables movies. The first scene of the first Expendables movie is Dolph Lundgren turning heel on Sylvester Stallone, right?
Yeah.
I don't care what you got to do. You make that deal so that Carl Weathers is Sylvester Stallone's best friend and Dolph Lundgren kills Carl Weathers to turn heel.
Yeah.
In the first Expendables movie. I sat there like, you guys did not recreate Rocky IV? Oh my God, I was just heartbroken. And I couldn't really get over it. I did think the first one is fun. I haven't seen the second one. No, but I see your point, but at the same time, though, you know, when you look at award seasons, you know, I mean, I remember going to see The Descendants, and the place was packed. You know, there are these movies. Boyhood has made a ton of money. I mean, they're still there. People, I think, you're right. I mean, look, if you make a really solid, wonderful indie movie, look at a recent favorite About Alex. I think that's a terrific film. It's not perfect. There's certainly criticisms of it, but I thought it was a really terrific film. It's not going to make Guardians of the Galaxy money. But I don't think, again, with your business model, it doesn't necessarily have to. You know, if you make a movie for two, you got to figure out a way to draw four or eight. You don't have to drink it. And a part of this, too, is also the enormous amount of promotional costs, which is just another 2 hours to talk about that publicity.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I did a show for TNT, let's just say, maybe. And I swear to God, our production budget was a fraction of our promotional budget. Like, but, I mean, even I was like, as a hardened industry vet, was like, you've got to be kidding me. How much they put into selling as opposed to actually making the thing. Some of the studios and stuff. But I think, though, it is exciting. I don't know. It's weird. It is a murky time, Chris, but I feel like it's an exciting time.
Oh, it absolutely is. There's no question about that. I mean, right now, if I were working in television, I would feel like I am in the golden age.
Mm.
Film is a little different. Film is having sort of an interesting time where the good on the high end is as good as it's ever been. And I will say this right now, Guardian of the Galaxy is the best big budget epic film ever made. The other hand is true too, though, that what's on lower down the budget is becoming more and more amazing, and at the same time becoming more and more accessible, and that's great to see.
Do you think binge watching will end up leading to a almost comeback for film? Because you hear it from people a lot in just regular conversation. Oh, I'm caught up on my TV. What's the next series? I'm looking for a series to watch.
Yeah.
But then some folks are saying, like, well, I can't invest. Oh, gosh, I don't have all weekend to watch a TV show. I wish I could just find some nice, compact story that's 2 hours long, and I get all the emotional sort of roller coaster that I get from a 10-episode series. I almost see a balance happening.
I see the TV movie making a giant comeback. And it already has, and people just haven't realized it. It's called Sherlock.
Sherlock is a great example. I have miniseries, too. I mean, look at Half Field McCoy, 18 million viewers. Holy cow.
That's right.
That and, shook the business.
And I have to say this. I was not expecting to enjoy Hatfield and McCoy as much as I did, and yet I really liked it. It was, again, I'm not its demographic, but I liked it.
But you know what's crazy, too? And here's the thing for the aspiring screenwriters and stuff who are listening is going, damn, well, I don't have that money. But at the core of all this stuff, you know, if you mention Hatfields and McCoys, Guardians of the Galaxy, Sherlock, Descendants, About Alex, and some of the and Cargo, by the way, is the name of the Australian zombie
Cargo!
Cargo. These are all compelling stories.
They are.
And frankly, writers listening out there, you just need a pen and paper. And the imagination and the inspiration.
And coffee. Don't forget coffee.
I drink tea these days, Chris. I quit coffee actually about 8 years ago.
Wow. You know, I do a podcast about tea called Leaf and Let Die. No joke. And the amazing thing is what I've discovered about tea that isn't true about coffee is when people are drinking tea, what they're talking about is what they're really interested in. When people are drinking coffee, what they're talking about is drinking coffee.
Hmm.
And so the Leaf and Let Die, we may have an entire episode where all we say about the tea is, yeah, this wasn't very good. But we'll talk about 100 other things.
Well, yeah, I was going to say I'd love to be on, but I don't know what I'd say other than I mix Earl Grey and I mix Lipton Black with other flavors and I make iced tea.
Well, it's
every
hilarious.
Day, that's what I do. And it's sometimes I have raspberry.
Oh.
Tomorrow I think I'm doing peach. I don't know. That's really it. Yeah.
We did an episode once where it was me and two of my friends and this random author who happened to be coming to a convention who I was like, oh, come on, sit down, let's talk. And so we ended up talking about estate planning law as it relates to what book was it? It was a Robert Silverberg novel in which 90% of the world's population died in the plague in the 1300s, and now it's coming back. And literally at the end, we just all stopped and said, we've all drank our tea. Anyone have any thoughts? Yes, but they're all about estate planning in fiction.
Yeah.
All right. Next week on Leave and Let Die. Yeah, well, I haven't done an episode of that for a while, but I love that concept.
Vince Gilligan also drinks iced tea. He's a big iced tea drinker, yeah. So, and he's a hero of mine. He's absolutely amazing. So, but anyway, we're coming up on time here. Before I let you go, I got to ask you about the Computer History Museum, of which you are a curator. Please tell us about this very interesting sounding establishment.
Well, we're originally founded in Boston as the Computer Museum, and that's actually where I started working back in 1998. And I found out that they had a outpost out here in California, and it was the winter of 98, and that was a terrible winter, so I came back home, and I've been here in Mountain View as a curator for 15 years, since 1999. And it's an amazing museum. It's the largest collection of computing memorabilia and artifacts in the world. And it's my sort of role is I am the video game, PCs, artificial intelligence, computer graphics, music, and art expert. And so my sort of gig is to sort of cover the areas of which touch on popular culture more.
Mm-hmm.
And so video games particularly is sort of one of the areas where I do a lot of my research. And in particular, also art is the other one. I've recently written two blog posts about Andy Warhol and
his use of the Amiga computer in the 1980s. So, you know, it's a fascinating thing. It's a story that's less than 50 years old, really. It's about 50, 55, 60.
But in that period of time, though.
It's been incredible.
I mean, like, it's mind-boggling to think, like, and there's a famous Doctor Who episode in Trial of a Time Lord in which the Doctor uncovers his villain's megabyte modem.
Yes.
Which is, you know, made fun of quite a bit. But back in 1986, a megabyte modem was the Starship Enterprise. That was an iPhone in 1986.
Exactly. When, you know, one of the things I often try to do is I try to relate what happens today with something that's happened in the past without comparing apples to apples, because everyone really wants to know, you know, how much faster is this than the computer I had in 1986? But the iWatch, or the Apple Watch, if you look at how what's led to that, you know, you have things like Dick Tracy's watch.
Sure.
You have things like the Casio watch that all the kids at Santa Clara High used to cheat on tests.
Not just Santa Clara.
I like to think we were innovators in that
you
area.
You might have done it first, but you weren't the only. How's that?
That's true. We may not have done it best. you know, it's like we're seeing, and what's amazing is that we're seeing things being reinvented over and over again. You know, the iPad, when it came out, the first thing I did was I went back and I looked in our stores and I found how many other things that had touch screens and that could do the things that the iPad could do, true, much slower. And, you know, when the iPhone came out, I was looking at all the things that had been phones. The first smartphone was 1993 and it completely bombed.
Right.
And so we have this sort of problem is that our innovation is so much faster than our ability to accept new technologies. And once we start to, you know, those two get that gap narrows, you can get inventions that get adopted immediately. And we're starting to see that a little bit, particularly in the area of apps.
Mm.
And what, you know, one of the things I really want to write a book about someday is how the release cycle has changed. And when software first started, it was all homebrew. It was all, you know, this is how you do it. You just take it, you put it out there, and people share it, and it starts to get a following, and then you make a product, and then there's a second wave, which was completely influenced by the film distribution method and the production methods. And then the third way that's happening now is you make it, you put it out there, you slap a little price tag on it. And it's the merging of the two traditional methods with a new method. And it's incredible to see how they sort of, how apps decay, how, yeah, you know, and there are still people clutching on to, you know, I'm one of those who refuses to use anything but my old versions of Photoshop, because I'll be damned if I'm going to go to the cloud. So there's all these sort of interesting stories about how people use technology, what they understand through technology, and how technology speaks to them. And I've been lucky enough to be a part of that, you know, for 15 years now.
It's funny, your shareware model is not that different from the independent movie model when you think about it. Like, putting it out there for free and then trying to get people to pay for it.
Exactly.
Which we've seen work now with Weird. And now you see the music business trying to catch up to that. With Weird Al was very successful with it. Mm-hmm. You too just did this very strange thing of just giving everybody the album.
That was very strange.
Very strange. We'll see if it works, though. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. What's weird is that has also launched for me, for a lot of friends of mine. Now they're really worried about the NSA. Because it's one thing to say, oh, they're spying on you. It's another thing to wake up and go to your phone and find shit there that you didn't put there. And
exactly.
That spooked a lot of people to be like, whoa, this isn't cool, you know?
I happen to subscribe to a saying from, I believe it was Scott McNeely, who said, you have no privacy, get over it. And once you've accepted that, what happens is you start to think before you link.
Yeah.
And that, you know, understanding that if you want something to be private, don't say it. And that whole concept is so difficult to grasp at first. And once you come to that, like, the entire history of computing is, how can we make machines more invasive in your life?
Well, that's true, and it's funny because I remember during the Boston bombing, a friend of mine was like, you know, oh my God, now the government's going to put cameras in every corner. And I'm like, why? The government just got thousands of hours of footage from private citizens. They don't need to do it. We're doing it.
Yeah, and that's really more of England's thing.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think we're almost more under surveillance here. But anyway, we'll have to save that for part two one day, Mr. Fabulous. But give us the final word on the Silicon Valley Science Fiction Short Film Festival. Can people still submit? And if they can't submit, how can people go and enjoy all these wonderful films you're collecting from over 50 countries?
Yeah, well, this year we are debuting on the 27th of September at the Convolution Science Fiction Convention in Burlingame, California. We're doing screenings in October in the beautiful cities of Boulder Creek and Mountain View. And then there'll be some more showings between late October through December in various cities around the Bay Area, and possibly a screening in the Toronto Bay Area, as we're calling it. Just keep a track of the Facebook group, facebook.com/ Silicon Valley Science Fiction Short Film Festival. It's going to be fantastic. We open up on December 1st to submissions for next year's festival, and you can search for us on filmfreeway.com to do all the submissions. We're absolutely free. The thing we absolutely believe in is that if you're a filmmaker, it's cost you enough. So we're not going to charge you to let us watch your movie. So,
well, amen to that.
Yeah, that's always been a pet peeve of mine. And, you know, when I always said, you know, when I'm running the show, it's going to be free to filmmakers. And darn it, I'm running the show.
Outstanding. Well, Chris, God almighty, we covered a lot of different things tonight, which I knew we would. I didn't even want to have like that strict a format because I knew that we would just zigzag all over the place, and it's been fantastic catching up with you again. And thank you so very much for taking the time to share these great insights on this ever-changing industry landscape.
Hey, always glad to, again, hear myself talk, but always glad to hear Handsome Timmy D and his brain droppings just landing all over the place.
Outstanding. We're here to help, ladies and gentlemen. So anyway, Chris, thanks so much. Thank you, dear reader, dear listener. If you like what you're hearing, please don't be shy about spreading the word over on social media, any kind of social media. Just tell people, listen. We very much appreciate it. And we got lots of exciting things coming up over the next few weeks with some people from post-production, some line producers, and all kinds of cool stuff. Right here, this is Tim Davis, and this is the Handsome Timmy D Express.